This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hi there, and welcome to the next in our mini-series of podcasts that we're running for Elgin Talks under the topic of what does net zero mean to you? I'm Lindsay Bass, Head of UK Consultant Relations at Elgin, and I'm joined again as my co-host for this mini-series by Laura Brown, Head of Client Solutions.
Hello.
Hello. So just as a quick reminder for why we wanted to host this series, that we've found ourselves recently having a lot of conversations with clients and consultants about net zero, repeatedly, in fact. And yet, while we have a consistent topic of conversation, the content and detail hasn't always remained quite so consistent. So we wanted to try and pull together some of the great and the good across asset owners and advisors to compare and contrast the views on just what net zero really means to them. But before we invite in our guest for today, Laura, I just wanted to have a quick catch up between us. What have you been seeing in this space in the last couple of weeks?
Thanks, Lindsay. Well, I guess we've been reflecting on the fact that with pension schemes only having around on the DB side 20% left in equities, credit seems to be where it's really at in the net zero space in terms of where trustees are starting to focus more and more. And I think when you start looking at credit portfolios, it does get really interesting in terms of the data and what that might drive you to do. So I've been working with clients on net zero aligned credit portfolios. And, you know, when we look at carbon emissions intensity, it's really concentrated in a very small number of sectors. So it'd be very easy to just cut some of those sectors out and have a much better portfolio. But it's a classic example, really, of one where we'd be decarbonizing the portfolio, but we'd be taking financing away from organisations that are actually going to help decarbonise the world. So lots of interesting discussions on that and how we therefore stay invested in those sectors, but in a way that we pick the companies that we think are better aligned on a forward-looking basis with where we need to get to.
That's really interesting. It's the kind of, do you fix it now or do you fix it in the future type of dichotomy, I guess, that is a really interesting one. And I'm sure our guest will have a number of thoughts on that as well. That's enough for us, but I really would like to now introduce our wonderful guests that we have today, and we'd welcome her views on all of these, as many others. Tegs Harding, Director at Independent Trustee Services Limited. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's a fantastic to have you here. Now, Tegs, you are a professional independent trustee on a number of schemes, so appreciate that the questions you can either answer as any particular one particular scheme, or you're welcome to kind of give a more holistic view. But I, you know, our first question always is, have you made a commitment to net zero and what is it? So feel free to answer it as whatever feels most appropriate for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of my schemes have made a net zero commitment, and where they have, that is generally because the sponsor has a net zero commitment themselves, and they were very keen for the pension scheme to reflect those values. And rather than anything specific, particularly in the early days, I've got one client in mind that sort of went quite early with net zero, sort of the start of 2020. It was just very much an acknowledgement that we kind of all need to do our bit to, if we're going to meet the goals of the Paris Agreement, rather than you know, any specific kind of metric in mind.
I had a bit of a question on that text, because one of the things that's really interested me is seeing clients set different target dates around net zero and often reflecting the sponsor. And my sort of natural perspective on that is that it's difficult for a pension scheme to have a target that's before 2050, because typically they want to be invested across all sectors, which will have quite different pathways. But really interested in your perspective from the client side, because I think that, you know, that it's quite a different view there if the sponsor's really pushing hard.
Yeah, I mean, this one is interesting because the sponsor's target was 2035, and they've actually since brought that into 2028. 2035 we thought was doable because that actually aligned with our own journey plan. So it's a very kind of typical time horizon that we would look at anyway. We did have a debate as to whether we should bring it in to 2028 to kind of reflect the views of the sponsor. But we actually thought, you know, what actions would we be doing differently if we were aiming for 2028 versus 2035? Would it make sense? And actually, in reality, does it make that much difference to our kind of business plan in terms of achieving our goals? And we decided that it probably didn't.
Yeah, that is a really interesting point around what difference does it make about taking action? Because I think, you know, setting an aspirational goal is effectively saying, well, we need to start taking action now, and really exactly what the date is doesn't matter, because we're going to do as much as we can as soon as we can, right? Which actually leads into to my next question for you, which is really, what are you doing for pension schemes who have made these commitments? Is it reviewing asset allocation? Is it looking at specific portfolios? Is it kind of manager selection oriented? What are the kind of priorities on your side?
Yeah, it absolutely encompasses all of that. Where we started in that case was really just understanding where we were starting from. So, you know, from a very basic level, having a conversation with the sponsor about how pension scheme assets are invested and the types of things that they might be invested in at the moment, because actually they didn't know how much of the scheme was exposed to fossil fuels, for example. So just getting that data from the managers was definitely the first job, and using that at the same time to share our initial kind of set of beliefs with them and asking them to map the portfolio against various criteria.
That's so interesting. I mean, I think one of our, you know, key follow-up questions to that is, data is kind of one of the fundamental issues, I think, here, and often, I think, used as a pushback as to why it's all too hard and too difficult. Do you have any particular tips for other trustees or anyone else in facing this challenge? How do they get through all this kind of complexity issue?
Yeah, I think it is a challenge, and we know it's going to evolve. I think start with what you can start with. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, right? You can start today. You can set yourself a climate risk budget. You can have an emissions reduction target. And if you have a decent enough illiquidity budget, you can add a real world impact target to that as well. So that will give you, you know, a good starting point. In the real world, you know you're going to want different data as it becomes available. So in particular, things like implied temperature rise. Having that across the portfolio is going to be really valuable, and we're just not quite there yet, but keep pushing those managers. And I think, you know, within a year, possibly even 18 months or so, that will definitely be available. I think the other thing to say on data is net zero isn't going to be a linear journey. Once you start measuring it, there will be times where your carbon exposure goes up. And that's because more companies are going to report. More companies are going to report accurately as standards improve around it. Companies that are only reporting scope 1 and 2 are going to start reporting scope 3. All of these things are going to come together. So it means that, you know, it's not going to be a straight line.
I think in practice, it feels to me, though, like trustees are going to end up therefore having to spend more time understanding the specifics of why sort of the data and climate benchmarks aren't performing in the way they expected, I suppose. I don't know, do you have any perspectives on how the kind of governance budget is going to work around that part of things?
No, I think, to be honest, that's an area that we really need to work on, and it's going to vary by scheme. You know, the bigger schemes with investment subcommittees and quite a lot of manpower to throw at this can spend the time. You know, on the real detail. It's much harder if you're a smaller scheme. You'll have fewer meetings. You probably don't have a subcommittee of specialists to look at it. Yeah, you're very reliant on your consultant to help you with things like that. So yeah, I definitely think governance is a challenge in this area.
Kind of moving on from that, but very much linked, what do you see as being the thorniest issues around net zero? Like, what is the stuff that's really going to be troublesome in terms of actually getting portfolios aligned and dealing with kind of controversial topics, I guess?
So some of the challenges are linked to what Lindsay was suggesting around this issue of fiduciary duty. You know, and I'm really pleased to see that the Work and Pensions Committee picked up on that idea, and they're calling for much greater clarity on the role of pensions in meeting the Paris Agreement goals. I think that would be really helpful. I think that's a kind of internal thing that we need to get over. I think there's some operational things because, you know, net zero isn't about meeting an arbitrary carbon target in our portfolios, right? It's about the impact we're having on emissions in the real world. And to do that, you need to be able to invest in thinking things that are helping with the green transition. And largely speaking, those are now privately traded rather than publicly. So we have a whole suite of operational challenges to get DC money invested in that space. It's definitely one as well. And then I think more on the controversial ones, I think it's more things like ensuring that a just transition, right? Because what's good from a climate perspective isn't necessarily good for people, certainly on a regional level. So how do you deal with some of those impacts? I mean, the what's happening with oil prices at the moment would be a really good example of that, right? Yes, it might speed up our green transition, but in the meantime, we're all having to pay £400 a year more on our gas bills, and some people just really can't afford that.
You mentioned earlier, Tegs, about stakeholders, and you know, certainly as a professional independent trustee, you have a number of different stakeholders in your process and across a number of different clients. How do you, it sounds like, you know, in some situations you've got fantastically supportive sponsors and that kind of filters down. Does it kind of hit brick walls? You know, do you come across quite challenging views within one kind of client framework, and how do you deal with that?
I think it's definitely an area where views can be quite diverse. I think everybody is now at the point where they recognise, no matter what their own views on climate risk are, that there is a transition happening, and that there's risk associated with that that we should be dealing with, because we deal with, like in the same way that we deal with every other risk in our portfolio, right? It's just one of those. I'd say what's changed in the last 18 months is how willing and just used to speaking about climate that the boards I deal with are. So I'm a trustee on a £30 million DB scheme, and that the sponsor is in the pharmaceutical sector. And they, you know, meet us quarterly, and they tell us about how the company's doing. And quite a lot of their presentation was talking about their own journey to net zero and what it meant for them. You know, they didn't want to come out publicly with, you know, a sort of arbitrary target that they couldn't meet. They were very keen on very real targets, so, you know, associated with particular plants. And once they started measuring in those, they realized that they could actually bring their goal forward hugely, because that, you know, there wasn't that much work to do. But I guess the point is, you're not bringing up a topic that people aren't used to and expecting to talk about now. I think boards are very experienced in this area and realize that, you know, a lot of times they're getting a cheaper cost of capital when they can demonstrate the climate credentials of their company. So it's a natural extension of the conversation to say, should we be investing in a similar way in the portfolio?
So that's great at the board level. What about where you're working with a range of different individuals that are on the kind of trustee perspective, as co-trustees perhaps?
I would say it's getting better. I think most people, you can't get away from the climate discussion now. So I think most people just understand a bit more about the issues. But it is then challenging to, when everybody has a slightly different view on what you should do about that, and whether, you know, people are still very nervous about this question of, is investing responsibly going to take away from returns in any way? Mm. And I think particularly when you get into some of the details in the credit space, that it is a difficult conversation.
There was interesting kind of publicity in the last few days, and I'm terrible because it's 4 M's, and that's really a challenge for me, from Make My Money Matter, and their research that was showing that, you know, only 30 out of the top 100 DB pension schemes have seemingly made a commitment to net zero so far. From your perspective out there on the front line talking to clients, do you expect that to increase dramatically over the coming weeks and months? What is your sense of, I think we can all see that there are corporates who are really leading the way, and often their pension scheme is going with them. But in the wider market, how fast do we think this is going to change? Because it does feel like it's changing pretty fast at the moment.
I'd say what's really positive is everybody's talking about whether they should, and whether they go as far as setting a net zero commitment. What they are doing is building climate metrics into the risk reporting that they might have. And they'll be setting some sort of target around that, whether that is a net zero emissions by 2050. They may not go that far, but I think everybody will be looking at it in some form or another. It was really interesting to me as well that one of the other things to come out of that work and pensions report that was published around COP26 was the call for the pensions regulator to define what net zero means. And I think if they do that, you might get more likely, you know, more people will pick it up because it's just easier to do.
So thinking on the sort of slightly on the negative side, but I'm, as an actuary myself, always on the, well, if we prepare for the worst, then we might hope for the best. Do you have any concerns about all of this? Is there anything that kind of worries you that we might be missing that could go wrong, that could really sort of set things back, both, you know, from a pension scheme perspective and the wider world, I guess?
I guess what are we missing? I think it's when you start thinking about the investment question differently, you're asking yourself, how am I going to invest over the long term to best, you know, meet the risk return objectives that I have and meet these climate objectives? You end up looking at things very differently. I mean, we're used to a world where our equity indices are based on market cap. And a lot of the sustainable indices still use that as a base, and they may tilt around it based on climate or other metrics, but that's still very much the basis. Whereas actually, if you were doing this from a completely blank piece of paper, you'd instead say, you know, what's going to be really important over the next few years? It's going to be healthcare provision. It's going to be investment in the circular economy. It's going to be renewable infrastructure, those sorts of things, and have your indices kind of built around that. I think the way we split between developed and emerging markets as well is probably not going to work in a world of quite significant climate change. We lump all sorts of places under the emerging markets banner, and they're going to be hit very differently by climate change. There's going to be, you know, opportunities there that we're missing, as well as risks that we're ignoring just because of some of the labels that we use.
It would be really interesting to see how that feeds into developments on the equity side over time, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think another interesting dynamic is going to be, you know, that there's so much money shifting towards sustainable investment now. We will get to a tipping point where the market is now sustainable. So anybody that hasn't done that will have to justify why their portfolio is performing differently to how the market is, and why they thought that, you know, the big investment in oil and gas or whatever it is that's causing that underperformance was a good idea. It's going to, and that kind of moment, I think, is actually closer than people realise, because a lot of retail money has already moved in this space.
Yes, it does feel like everything that's going on at the moment is just going to shine a light more and more on sort of narrowing down for an individual pension scheme, which part of my portfolio have I sorted out and which other bits are still looking a bit more concerning. And yeah, at an industry level, well, which schemes or asset managers are sorted out and which ones are looking a little bit wobblier. And that seems to be a classic example of shining a light on things, or, you know, disclosure, what's measured gets managed kind of concept, right? Because once we can see it and everybody can see it, it just changes the sort of ability to address it. So it does, I mean, that seems like it has just changed so much in the last year in this space, which is amazing.
Yeah. I wanted to just pick up on, you know, your kind of thoughts around benchmarks and kind of what more sensibly should be, you know, we should be thinking about from an investment perspective, looking ahead. Just wondering about the schemes that you currently sit on. I know you touched on it very briefly at the beginning about what you're actually doing. Is there anything that you either are doing or would really like to do, but maybe you don't have yet in your portfolios to kind of get those schemes into an ideal scenario?
So what we are doing, definitely where we are using passive equities, a lot of schemes are looking at alternative indices to those. I think, you know, it's definitely better than just investing on a market cap basis. And, you know, there's lots of different flavors around that. Some it's just carbon, some have, you know, wider ESG tilts as well. I think what I would really like to see more of is a way of measuring the real world impact rather than the portfolio level emission statistics, because I think that is ultimately what we're trying to do here. So I think at the moment, a lot of the products kind of use slightly the wrong lens.
So does that mean a lot more impact investing?
Yeah, I think so. I think impact investing is a scary term for a lot of these, because you get right to the heart of this fiduciary debate, right? But where it works in a portfolio, it's hitting the risk return characteristics. It's not leaving you terribly concentrated in any one kind of asset class. you know, why not? Why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, I think it is an interesting area. As you say, it can be a little scary, and to some extent with good reason, that I suppose that the challenges, especially over the defined benefit pension scheme time horizon, that lots of new emerging technologies, you know, there's a discomfort amongst trustees about how do we make sure we're backing the ones that are going to be successful, especially given all the chat in the papers every day about this new hydrogen thing over here, this new, you know, ground source heat pump over there, or whatever it might be. So I guess that there's a really big role for asset managers there in giving comfort around how we bring together these portfolios. But yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on sort of how to help people get through that kind of concern about newness almost.
Yeah, and I think it's going to have to be an area that all of the chain of how we work as an industry works on, because consultants are going to have to get their research in place when fund managers launch new products. And that is going to have to accelerate quite a lot. That's one of the concerns I have at the moment, actually, is just whether the consulting chain can keep pace with the change that we're seeing in the industry. And then that will naturally trickle down to trustee boards as you know, things like LDI did. They started with the bigger schemes, and 10 years later, everybody's doing LDI. You know, we don't have time to wait 10 years for these things to be standard in people's portfolios.
Yeah, no, it definitely makes sense. It feels like it's a combination between giving comfort around having a good level of diversification when you look to do these things, but equally having the comfort that you've got real subject matter expertise. You know, it's not just about investing in things, but it's actually asset management, you know, the sort of engineering perspective on some of the assets that you end up holding, which, yes, does create some challenges for our current sort of model, I think, at times in terms of how we research that.
And especially how you can fit some of those asset classes in a DC model.
Yeah.
A master trust model, because you know, DB schemes are de-risking, and they're going to end up with a big portfolio of gilts and bonds, right? There's no getting away from that. but other types of investor, institutional investor, will be invested for longer.
My sense from all of this conversation is actually a positive one, Tegs. So thank you. In that, while there are obviously some challenges, you know, there's some real positives. The trend is our friend, and it is moving in the right direction. And there's a lot of people who are very very supportive, so that's really comforting. I mean, I think the point that you make also from the investment perspective, that, you know, and related to the fiduciary duty, is actually there's this quite kind of sense, I think, from some trustees perhaps, that there's like a FOMO. There's like, well, if we move to this kind of climate friendly portfolio, are we missing out over here, and is that a bad thing? But actually, as you say, it is possible to find the investments that you want that can fulfill both objectives and still give you the return and risk requirements that you need. So that gives me some degree of comfort looking ahead. So thank you. That brings us, I think, to the end of our session today. So thank you, Tegs, for joining us. It was fitting that you are our second guest for this podcast, because you were this morning on a panel with Tim Manuel, who was also our first guest. So thank you. I know you were speaking at the PLSA this morning, and we hope that our listeners have also enjoyed this session. Please do subscribe if you haven't already to LGIM Talks, wherever you get your podcasts, and stay tuned for the next episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, LGIM.com.